Counsel, for the next argument, feel free to approach and get yourself settled in. All right, and counsel, I know you're both familiar with our procedures. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes and then 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. As you both know, the podium is adjustable, so feel free to get settled in before you begin your argument. And with that, I'll have the marshal call the next case.
Now calling A240727, State of Minnesota versus Xavier Lee Hudson.
All right, and counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravili. I am representing the appellant in this case, Mr. Xavier Hudson. This appeal challenges Mr. Hudson's convictions at trial, primarily on the issue of the state failing to disprove his self-defense claim. It also challenges his convictions for aiding and abetting intentional second-degree murder or insufficient evidence. The self-defense issue in this case, if I can crystallize it, and based on all the arguments made at trial by both counsel, it seemed to boil down to whether a reasonable person being shot at multiple times would shoot back until the danger is gone. It seemed that the state's argument really turned on that. The theory was that it was an excessive number of shots, and I think it's appropriate for me to just get that primary issue right out in the open and address it, and of course field any questions the court may have. The self-defense claim, as all, it deals with four prongs. There was never any dispute that the first shooter, Dawson, was the aggressor in the incident. And just based on the evidence alone, it would seem readily apparent that the reasonable belief or fear of harm was present, and that was objectionably reasonable based on what was happening, based on the description of so many witnesses, all of whom were called by the state. The evidence clearly showed that Dawson decided to return to the house, according to his son, with the intention of finding Mr. Hudson, as well as Mr. Davila and JT, because of the dispute that had occurred in the driveway a short time earlier. And that, as witnesses described, the Tahoe slowed and multiple shots were fired. I think it's key, again, to address the reasonableness of the response, to reiterate that when the weapon of Dawson was found, the magazine was empty. In his own statement to the police, once he confessed to firing first, he stated that he fired like 7 shots. So given the capacity of the magazine, we know it was at least 7 or 8 shots. There was a dispute about, what angle of firing there was at the scene. As I've cited in my brief, in addition to Mr. Hudson, at least one other witness, Y.E., saw the Tahoe as it was firing pull forward and stop briefly. The forensic evidence elicited by the state showed that there was a bullet hole in the right rear passenger door frame and the back side of it, so the part bordering the trunk, indicating a shot was fired at an angle behind the driver of the Tahoe, Dawson, which lended forensic physical evidence and support to Mr. Hudson's claim that the Tahoe kept firing after it went past him. that the danger was not just limited to an approaching vehicle, but one that kept going. There was an additional dispute about where Mr. Hudson was. I thought it was appropriate in my brief to point out that at least five witnesses said that Dawson fired in the direction of the truck, which is where Mr. Hudson and Davila and JT were standing by, according to multiple witnesses, BB, who was in the Kia, TR, MG at the scene, and Mr. Dawson himself. The thing is, the red car that Mr. Hudson came in was right next to the Tahoe, but it must be added to this that multiple witnesses, as I described in my brief, stated that they saw the driver of the Tahoe shooting at Mr. Hudson. This would also seem, I argue here, to square away the issue of duty to retreat, that it cannot be reasonably expected under the law when you're being shot at that your duty is to turn and run or just duck and hope you don't get shot. I'm not only relying on the old Gardner case for that premise, which found it to be folly to think that if you're being shot at, you have to run because you can't outrun a bullet. I also found useful in my brief this court's decision in Baker. It's a recent decision. It's non-precedential. But the analysis there was helpful because the facts were almost the same. The defendant in that case was being shot at as he was standing by his vehicle. This court found the idea that he was supposed to run or take the time to get into his car to take cover would keep exposing him to the danger of the gunfire. The only reason the Baker court did not reverse is because Baker in that case ran after his assailant, shooting him. In other words, took an aggressive posture. That didn't happen here. There doesn't seem to be any disagreement that at some point during his return fire, Mr. Hudson became prone. Further illustration that he was doing what a reasonable person would do in this situation. The state's case at trial seemed to really emphasize the idea of what they thought Mr. Hudson should have done.
Can I just interrupt, just two quick fact questions for clarification? Is it undisputed that Mr. Hudson did not fire until after Mr. Dawson had fired his seven shots?
No, that would be disputed because in Mr. Hudson's statement that was admitted into evidence, he said that Dawson got off a couple of shots before he was able to get his weapon and return fire. And then more shots were fired, either during which or immediately after the additional shots were fired.
Does the other witness testimony support that?
The other witnesses don't describe any specific sequences of shots, obviously. But to me, the witnesses that provide the most objective idea of what happened are the two called by the state that weren't there. They were the neighbors down the street who heard all the gunfire because they were up. I think one of them was in his front yard. The person down the street, GC, said that the shooting lasted for like 5 seconds. The witness, MM, said that it happened really fast and that it was about the time it would take a little pack of firecrackers to go off. Multiple witnesses at the scene described it all happening within seconds. The notion that it took several minutes is just not plausible.
How many shots are we talking about? We're talking about 19?
19 from my client, seven or eight from Dawson, yes.
Okay. So that's the universe of shots, but I mean, and the witnesses are saying they heard 19 shots within the span of a few seconds?
No witness specified, the point I was trying to make is that no witness was able to specify how many shots they heard. I think a couple of them just said it was a lot. But, of course, they all describe seeing the Tahoe firing first. This point about the duration, it definitely goes to the heart of how reasonable was the response. I've relied on several cases, which I don't think were addressed by a respondent, that were the only ones I could find about situations just like this. They happen to deal with police officers. I have made the point, I hope clearly, that Statute 609.06 does not place any less of a burden on a police officer than a civilian for the degree of force used, the reasonableness of it. It only permits police officers to use deadly force in additional circumstances, like during an arrest or to prevent an escape. So I found the cases that I cited.
For those reasons, are those cases on point? I mean, if the standards that govern the amount of force that a police officer may use are different than the standards that govern the amount of force a private citizen may use, are the cases necessarily on point?
That's what I was not able to find. And I would cite the Housley case that I cited first from 1982 as an example of where police had actually gone into Housley's home unannounced, or Housley didn't hear them. He thought they were burglars, and he saw one of them raising a gun, so he opened fire like four times. And one of the cops was seriously injured, but they reversed his first-degree assault conviction because they focused on, was his response reasonable in the moment? And under the same standard of review applicable here, the Supreme Court said it was.
But it seems to me what you're asking us to do is to judge whether Mr. Hudson's response was reasonable as compared to the responses of police officers described in case law, even though under law those police officers have wider latitude in the use of deadly force.
But see, that is what is not existing in the law. There's none of that language that's in the statute of 609.06. There is not. There is no case law that declares police have wider latitude in defending their lives against people shooting at them.
But what I'm saying is, what you're saying is the statute gives the police officers, it allows for more circumstances in which the police may use deadly force than a public person may.
That is what I have laid out in my brief, yes.
And Mr.
Yes.
Marvili, was the jury asked was the jury asked the self-defense question separately multiple times, once with respect to each charge, or was there a single verdict form or a single question about self-defense overall?
I believe the instruction was given for every count because it was applicable. You know, the rest of the counts were felony murder and that involving the offense of assault.
And your argument on appeal is that you're challenging the sufficiency of the evidence with respect to self-defense on all charges or just the murder charge?
Well, in my brief, I had the attempted second-degree murder charges for the sufficiency of evidence claim.
Well, that's in part two. But in part one, I guess,
all
I'm wondering
them.
If
yes.
You're challenging the self-defense, the sufficiency of evidence negating self-defense with respect to which
yes.
charges?
Yes, I believe in my brief I argued that all of his convictions should be reversed because he was defending himself. All of the actions required for those offenses would be excused by a legitimate self-defense claim that he wasn't intending to assault or he wasn't intending or to help assault or intending to help murder anyone. He was defending his life.
Does the evidence show that the Kia vehicle was moving, correct, during the incident?
Well, except
while it was fired upon?
Except when the Tahoe stopped, as witness Y.E. described.
At the beginning of the altercation? And then they drove away?
No, the Tahoe would have stopped. I mean, the whole sequence, again, it lasted maybe 10 seconds. The Tahoe would have stopped past Mr. Hudson, which is again supported by the bullet hole in the rear part of the Tahoe vehicle. Again, and I would also add the forensic analyst agreed that there couldn't be any evidence of how many shots went out the back window once it was open or shattered. But the sequence of firing occurred within that limited time frame during which the Tahoe approached slowly, firing, then stopping. At that point, Mr. Hudson described wondering whether Mr. Hudson was going to get out of the vehicle.
I guess what the question I was leading up to is, Do we know where the Kia vehicle was when the fatal shot bounced off the license plate?
It was behind the Tahoe as they were leaving the scene. And in the time I have left, I would just like to emphasize one thing I noticed in my preparation for today was State's Exhibit 3, the aerial map of the neighborhood. It shows the house where the shooting, where the party was, at a bend in the road, and then in the direction that the Tahoe and the Kia fled, just a short distance away, there's another bend in the road to the right. So that just seems to undermine the state's theory that the shooting went on that long. Before very long at all, it would have been a matter of seconds, the vehicles were out of sight. And
in terms of the response, reasonableness of the response, my understanding is there's evidence in the record that there were five shots from Mr. Hudson with a pause, and then 14 shots that followed where he said, I opened fire.
That's what he said, yes.
Okay.
And that's what he explained was the case because the vehicle stopped and he wondered what was happening. But I think what the facts can support is that, and why I cited the Liebfried case from this court, if I can just finish my point, in reviewing the termination of an officer, this court noted that the police training manual said that all police are trained when they're being fired at to return fire as many times as necessary to stop or neutralize a deadly threat. I fail to see how that cannot apply to a civilian who is shot at 8 times by admission of the first aggressor. Thank you.
Could I just ask one quick question just to wrap up another point and clarify? So you're saying as to issue one on self-defense, if self-defense was not disproved, your client's, all of his guilty verdicts should be reversed?
Yes.
As to issue two, you're saying that insufficient evidence of intent
independent of the
It would just be issue. The count, the amended count charging intentional murder that would get reversed.
My argument is that if this court were to decide that the self-defense claim was disproved, it must still reverse the intentional murder counts.
Understood. Okay. If this court were to decide that the self-defense claim was not disproved and we're left with just the second issue goes only to the charge of second-degree intentional murder. Is that correct?
Well, since finding that self-defense was not disproved would reverse all of the convictions, the second
Okay,
argument.
I stated that wrong. Let's say we think the state disproved self-defense, just
right.
for argument purposes. And then we go to your next argument. Should your next argument regarding sufficiency of the evidence address only the count of intentional murder?
Yes, because...
Okay, so if he prevailed on that count, he would still stand convicted of unintentional murder in addition to all the other assault charges.
That is what my brief argued, and it's, right. again, based on a finding that there was no self-defense. I
Understood.
Needed to present... Okay, and I was relying on the State v. Isaac case in my reply, specifically on that issue. Perhaps I can address it in my rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, go ahead and... adjust the podium, get settled in, and you may begin when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Jackla. I represent the state of Minnesota. One point counsel made toward the end that I think is very important and I don't want it to get overlooked is Mr. Mirabili said that the fatal shot that traveled through the license plate and ended up killing the victim was fired as the Kia was, quote, leaving the scene. And I think that's ultimately what this case comes down to, is that the Tahoe and the Kia were both retreating by the time that that the fatal shots were fired, and frankly, the vast majority of the shots that were fired from Mr. Hudson and Mr. DeVia. The issue was originally framed by counsel as whether a reasonable person being shot at would return fire until the threat is gone. I agree. That is a good way to encapsulate this case. The disagreement that we have is when that threat actually was gone. And the jury had a number of different considerations to weigh. But one of the most telling and most important in this case is the fact that there was this break in the shooting by Mr. Hudson. As the court pointed out, there were initially, taken directly from Mr. Hudson's statement, there were initially five shots that were fired by Mr. Hudson. And he admitted in his statement that there was a break in the action, and he, after he fired off those first five shots, he looked down the road, assessed the situation, checked on his girlfriend who was in the vehicle, and then began firing off another 14 rounds. Now, what Mr. Hudson says prompted him to do that is the fact that there were the initial shots that came from Mr. Dawson, and he, after those initial shots, he took off down the road. But Mr. Hudson said that the vehicle came to a screeching halt. This Tahoe driven by Mr. Dawson came to a screeching halt, which made him then concerned that there would that Mr. Dawson would leave the vehicle or that he would begin firing again. But there is not a shred of evidence in the record outside of Mr. Hudson's own statement that the Tahoe ever came to a screeching halt. I don't dispute that the vehicle may have slowed down as it approached the Tahoe. And to the extent there's any confusion about from witnesses about vehicles stopping or slowing down or the sequence of events, we have to remember that there were two vehicles that were moving in tandem here, the Tahoe and the Kia. And the driver of the Kia testified that he was following close behind within one car length of the Tahoe, and when the Tahoe slowed down due to his proximity to that vehicle, that's when he needed to slam on his brakes and stop so as to avoid hitting the vehicle in front of him. So we have these two vehicles that are traveling in close sequence, and a situation that is very volatile and hostile, and perhaps witnesses' observations were a bit muddled by the confusion of the moment.
And how does that specifically relate to an issue of the case?
Well, the break in the action between the two shots, I think, is critical to this court's review of the self-defense theory, because perhaps, and I'm certainly not conceding this point, but at some point, perhaps there was a moment where Mr. Hudson did have fear for his life. But what happened as he made his, as that threat abated with Mr. Dawson taking off down the road, he recognized that situation. He recognized that the threat is moving away from him, and the imminency of the threat just isn't there. So I think what happened is we transferred from a point possibly of self-preservation to a mindset of vengeance and retribution.
What do we know about, as the Tahoe is moving away, about shots being fired from the Tahoe?
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record that the Tahoe fired more than one sequence of shots. So there were the initial shots that rang out as Mr. Dawson came cruising past the property. But Mr. Hudson is the only witness who suggests that there were separate sequences of shots that were fired by Mr. Dawson. And in fact, I think what the record more clearly demonstrates, based on testimony from witnesses and, in fact, the driver of the Kia that was behind the Tahoe, is that as soon as these initial shots were fired, the Tahoe and the Kia took off down the street as soon as those shots were done. There is no evidence that there was any kind of stopping that there was any second series of shots that were fired as Mr. Dawson was making his way down the road. And if we look at the two vehicles following in close proximity and understanding that the reason Mr. Dawson, and I'm certainly not excusing his actions by any means, he was appropriately prosecuted and is currently in prison, but the reason that he went to that party was to vindicate and protect his children from a threat that he saw. So if we look at the way that these two vehicles are traveling, the notion that Mr. Dawson would roll up, fire some shots out the vehicle, take off down the street a short ways, and then turn behind himself and shoot when there's a vehicle full of his children and their friends right behind them, I don't believe that's reasonable, because what he's doing then is endangering the very people that he is supposedly trying to protect.
I'd like to shift to the second issue. We can always come back to the first, but the second issue about sufficiency of evidence on aiding and abetting intentional second-degree murder. In an appellant's reply brief, Mr. Maravilli cites the Isaac case, recent case from the state Supreme Court, which says that the evidence must show that the defendant, quote, knew that the shooter was going to commit murder, end quote, and, quote, intentionally aided the shooter in the commission of that crime, that specific crime, not just any crime. So is that, I'm wondering if you have a response to that, if you share in the Mr. Marvelli's understanding of that case, and if you can explain how your evidence shows that the only reasonable inference from the evidence is that that Mr. Hudson knew that Mr. Davila was intending to commit intentional second-degree murder, and he intended to aid him in that crime.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. And I'm glad to have an opportunity to address this Isaac case, because I think it certainly helps the state more than it does the appellant. In the Isaac case, the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed a conviction that was founded on accomplice liability for first-degree murder. And the critical fact in that case was that the alleged conspirator or the alleged accomplice was more than 100 miles away from the scene of the murder when it occurred. And the point that the Supreme Court found most telling is that there was no evidence in the record showing any type of cooperation or affirmative statements that that Mr. Isaac knew about what was going to be happening at this murder that took place 100 miles away from where he was. The facts of this case stand in stark contrast. Here we have Mr. Davila and Mr. Hudson basically standing shoulder to shoulder, firing their semi-automatic handguns at the same target, moving down the street. So the Isaac court outlines
couldn't that be simply that they both wanted to commit assault against the people in the car? I mean, in other words, what evidence is there that Mr. Davila intended to kill and that Mr. Hudson intended to help Mr. Davila kill?
Well, I think the evidence showing that each of them intended to kill was that the 19 shots fired by Mr. Hudson and the 21 fired by Mr. Davila were all directed at the Tahoe itself. Mr. Hudson even told police that, yes, this is what I was aiming at. I was aiming at this Tahoe that was moving down the street. I think to provide a little bit of context for your question, Judge Johnson, is it helps to look at the Isaac case and what it said. And Isaac laid out a rubric for getting in the mind of the participants in a crime. And that decision says the requisite mental state, and the mental state is the intention to aid or abet. The requisite mental state can be inferred from a variety of facts. So the court is not just limiting it to a short series of steps that the court would follow, but indicating that there is a broad range of evidence that might support this this element of the offense. And those variety of facts include presence at the scene of the crime together. Clearly, that's met here. We have these two who are standing shoulder to shoulder. A close association between the two participants. There's a very clear record here of the association between Mr. DeVia and Mr. Hudson. Mr. Hudson said during his statement to police that basically I'm the only person that Mr. DeVia has. I'm his person. Mr. Hudson saw and knew that DeVia was carrying. He described in great detail to officers the type of weapon that Mr. DeVia had and even the type of ammunition that he was using. The Isaac Court also guides us to look at the offender's response to the principal offender's behavior, if there's any type of surprise or shock that this is happening. And the final factor that the court advises to look at is if the two parties fled the scene together, which, again, clearly in this case, they did. So having these two people standing next to each other, firing at the same target at the same time, is strong evidence that there was a conspiracy. They knew what their intent was, each of them, by firing at the vehicle.
Counsel, I just because time is limited, for the circumstantial standard, which I think everybody agrees we need to apply here, we first ask, is one of the reasonable inferences from the circumstances proved guilt? And I think you've just described why you would say that guilt is a reasonable inference. Mr. Marvili is arguing there's another reasonable inference, that being that they weren't intending to kill anyone, they were just trying to ward off an attack. Would you address for us why you think that is not a reasonable inference to be drawn from these facts?
Certainly. Number one, with Mr. Hudson, I raised this point a number of times in my brief, and counsel rejected it in his response, but the undisputed evidence shows, and this is straight from Mr. Hudson's statement, is that he was protected behind the red vehicle when the initial shots came out. And he provided a detailed explanation of what he did. He's on the hood when the Tahoe rolls up. He senses that there's some kind of danger. DeVia tells him that there's some kind of danger. And he makes his way, after the first and second shots, he ducks behind the vehicle, and he makes his way back to get his gun. At that point, Mr. Hudson returns to check on his girlfriend, make sure you're okay, telling her that she needs to duck. He prostrated himself behind the vehicle, laying down, covered by a vehicle that's right in front of him, and he begins shooting. That takes a certain amount of time just to engage in that series of events. So as he's doing that and as he has that break, he's got an opportunity to either stay where he is and avoid the danger, or to flee, as the self-defense statute raises as one element of for the state to disprove the defense. And I see I'm running out of time here, Judge Larkin.
I have a follow-up on that. Why isn't the facts that you described just now still consistent with the theory of warding off an attack?
Because I think the record clearly shows that the attack was done by the time the majority of these shots were fired. And that's the point I was getting to, is that the initial shots prompted Mr. Hudson to take cover and defend himself, and the undisputed evidence in the record shows that after the shots were fired by Mr. Hudson, they took off down the street. And not only took off down the street, but had to go around a curve. And so the fact that the offensive vehicle, the Tahoe, is moving away at the time of the shooting shows that the threat had abated. It was not imminent, as the case law requires. There was no need for those shots to be fired at that point because the threat had moved on.
So, I mean, put another way, I guess your argument is the first five shots may have been to ward off, but then the next 14 were not?
Exactly. And I'm certainly not conceding that the first five shots were even necessary or reasonable or appropriate in those in that situation, but certainly the second round of shots that Mr. Hudson fired were unreasonable and unnecessary, and that's where the criminal offense certainly comes in.
Mr. Maravilli emphasizes the fact that the bullet defects in the vehicles were the on the lower parts of the car, which would be consistent with not shooting to hit the occupants, but rather just to hit the vehicle. What do you say about that?
Well, I say we should look at Mr. Hudson's own statement, because he described the two sequences of shots that he fired off in different manners. He said the first shots that he fired off were more controlled, that he probably spent a little bit more time or effort aiming. The second round of shots, after the vehicle was making its way down the street, those were he began open firing and was giving less care to where he was actually shooting. So to suggest that open firing, and those are his words, as the vehicle is traveling down the street, was purposefully aimed low so as to provide a warning shot, but not something that might intend to harm an occupant of one of the vehicles, I just don't think it withstands a view from reality.
Well, does open firing, is that necessarily, does that necessarily imply intentional second-degree murder?
I mean,
if I'm intending to kill somebody with a firearm, I would aim and, you know, it would be more controlled and pointed directly at the person rather than open firing suggests sort of scattershot.
Yeah, I don't think they're at all in opposition. I think you can certainly have both, knowing that there's a target a certain distance away and then just unloading your weapon in a sequence of moving across an area in order to try to hit a target. I don't think that those two ideas are mutually exclusive. I think you can open fire with the intent of harming or killing somebody.
Could I ask?
Yeah, please.
And maybe Mr. Maravilli can address this as well. In addition to saying opening fire, Mr. Hudson told the police he saw ED shooting like American Sniper or something.
Yeah.
What do we make of American Sniper?
I think that's a very important fact, because it shows that the Tahoe and the Kia were quite a ways down the road. And the context of that statement arose in Mr. Hudson almost joking with police, saying, yeah, you know, my buddy Davila, he kept firing even longer than I did. You know, as this vehicle is traveling all the way down the street, a block and a half away, like, who does this guy think he is, American Sniper? And I think the allusion there is from the movie involving Chris Kyle and shooting from long distance. There was a movie a number of years ago, The American Sniper, and that was...
And he also told the police, I wish the dad would have died. I wish he would have passed away.
Correct. And I think that speaks to intent of Mr. Hudson and also the fact that he recognized on reflection when talking to the police that this is something I shouldn't have done. You know, this I shouldn't have shot. It was wrong. He used that word, it was wrong. So that certainly shows a consciousness of guilt. And to build on that, if somebody truly believes they acted in self-defense, that they didn't do anything wrong, why leave the state for 2 weeks? Why take off driving to Florida for 2 weeks, especially when Mr. Hudson is seeing all these police officers responding to the scene, coming to his house, and he said he sat there all night and watched these police officers. He heard them calling his name. If he truly believed that he did the right thing, he acted in self-defense, why not go and talk to the police and say, hey, here's what happened. I don't know what you think happened, but this is what I saw, and this is why I acted the way I did. The fact that he didn't, that demonstrates a consciousness of guilt that certainly goes to the the intent element.
Guilt of what, though? I mean, I saw these circumstances in your brief at page 28, paragraphs 15, 16, and 17, but how do those circumstances point specifically to second-degree intentional murder and not to other crimes of which he was charged?
Are there specific fact sequences you're referring to?
Well,
Your
somebody
Honor?
Who commits, say, a first-degree assault might leave town because they're concerned about being charged with first-degree assault. But somebody charged with second-degree intentional murder might leave town because of that. But how do we know which? In other words, I mean, how do we take away from his going to Florida the fact that he intended to commit a very specific crime rather than just he intended some other crime or he was concerned about prosecution in general?
Yeah, and that's a good question.
I mean, in other words, why is the only reasonable inference from those circumstances second-degree intentional murder?
Well, I think what comes down to the most important question is whether a person, in order to be charged with that offense, must have this meeting of the minds, knowing that this is the particular type of offense that we're going to commit. I don't think the case law requires that. I don't think the case law requires, in terms of accomplice liability, for both to know exactly what degree of offense we're talking about. And I think the same is true with
Mr. Marabili says that Isaac requires exactly that.
I don't think that's a fair extension from Isaac at all. Particularly when you get down into the granularity of certain offenses where we might have a shooting that results in a death. Well, we know there's multiple degrees of homicide, and there doesn't need to be a recognition by an offender that, boy, I'm committing second-degree murder here, and I'm going to leave because I committed second-degree murder versus I'm going to leave because I committed a first-degree assault. I think just the act of fleeing demonstrates this consciousness of guilt, and the case law doesn't require the offender to engage in that deep of analysis to really come to this clear mental picture that I'm leaving because of this offense versus another. I hope that answers your question. I'm not sure it does, but.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you, and there's a number of points I'd like to address. I think I'll just start and go backwards as fully as I can. I maintain that State v. Isaac does require not just specific intent, but specific knowledge of the offense, in this case, the intentional second-degree murder.
Can I ask a question on that point?
Yes.
Because we're in the world of circumstantial evidence, and intent is normally proven circumstantially. Now, you could have a case where you have co-defendants and one says, I'm going to kill this guy. Well, that's an easy case to analyze. In a case like this, where there is no stated intent, is it wrong for us to say, well, what are the circumstances proved? Do those show that the co-defendant had intent? And if so, and Mr. Hudson was aware of those circumstances, is that adequate to establish his knowledge? Not a true question, I just don't know as I think through this. Is that how we would analyze this?
The test from Isaac is simply that there was aiding and abetting and that it was that the co-defendant, in this case my client, knew that the specific offense was going to occur before it occurred.
Can that knowledge be based on circumstances, or does it have to be based on what we would consider direct evidence?
Well, it would be based on the circumstances proved, okay, as it was in Isaac. And I should also point out, I'm not relying on Isaac for the fact so much as I am for its standard.
Right.
It sharpened and clarified the Milton case that respondent had relied on. I want to address the issue of how the intent is, but first, Mr. Hudson did not leave the party with Mr. Davila. He left with the people he came with. The trip to Florida, there is no evidence in the record that that was his idea. He was 17 at the time. It appears to have been his mother's idea. And it's worth noting that he came back and went straight to the police to give a statement. This issue of the timing, every time I hear a respondent describe the sequence, it sounds like something that happened over an incredibly long period of time, given the issue as it was described by the witnesses. I am relying heavily on not just my client's own claim, but the state's forensic evidence that Mr. Dawson was firing behind himself as he went past. The danger continued past the point where Mr. Dawson was. The notion that Mr. Dawson or Mr. Hudson was undercover behind the red car is contradicted by all the witnesses who saw him having to duck because he was getting shot at. And respondent's position seems to be, well, then the only way he could have legitimately defended himself was to jump out in the open. There was no way to actually fire at and strike any of the vehicles to ward them off unless he had a clear line of fire.
Do you disagree that the evidence shows that the second round of shots from Mr. Hudson and the other shooter occurred as the Tahoe was driving away?
It would have been after the Tahoe was past them, yes. But that was the point where the Tahoe stopped. And again, responded.
So just, as you understand the facts, the Tahoe either slowed down or stopped, fired these shots. There was an exchange, five shots from Mr. Hudson. Then the Tahoe started to drive away, and that's the point at which we have 14 and 19 shots?
See, I don't know whether all of the shots from the Tahoe were continuous or not. I just know that they continued past Mr. Hudson's position. And well enough.
You don't know where, you don't know when. Does the evidence tell us whether the shots from the Tahoe, any of them, were fired during the course of shooting from Mr. Hudson and his companion, the 14 and 19 shots? I think you said your client testified he got off a couple of shots before the shots from the Tahoe ended. But it doesn't sound like there was any evidence that the Tahoe was, shots were coming from the Tahoe when the second round shot started.
That isn't clearly established by any statement. It's what's okay. Clearly established is that the Tahoe was still firing after it was passed where my client was in a defensive position. And the question then becomes whether the threat stopped. I mean, the fact that the shots came from a vehicle driving away is the whole point here, and there's physical evidence of that. The threat did not stop when the Tahoe was still in front of the truck and the red sedan. But continued as they went past.
The exchange you had with Judge Larkin gets to the circumstances proved.
Yes.
And in evaluating the circumstances proved, we have to take it in the light most favorable to the verdicts.
Yes.
And in doing so then, in the light most favorable to the verdicts, wouldn't we assume from that testimony that, all right, there's the initial exchange of shots, a pause, 19 more shots with no more shots coming from the Tahoe at that point?
This must assume, for the reasonable person in that position, that there was no way any more shots could come from the Tahoe, which is absurd. The fact is that Mr. Hudson said when the vehicle stopped, the Tahoe stopped, he wondered if he was going to get out. There's also the issue of whether he was just reloading. The vehicle didn't stop being a threat, especially since it was still firing past Mr. Hudson's position, until it was out of sight or until it was out of range of firing. And as I showed or referenced on the map, it's a short distance away before there's a bend in the road and the vehicle would have been out of sight. Traveling this distance would take 1 or 2 seconds. The point that I need to emphasize in my argument is that all of this happened in a very quick period, 10 seconds. The number of shots fired are as reasonably described as being in response to and warding off a threat as they are that you know, somehow the threat stopped existing, which doesn't make any sense.
I need to ask this. You keep saying 10 seconds, but we've got 5 shots and then 19 shots, so that's 24 shots. So what, we have 2 shots a second?
Your Honor, apart from my own experience with weapons, I can say based on that experience and training in the U.S. military, all you have to do is watch a movie, and you can see how fast you can fire off 15 shots with a handgun. You can do that in less than 5 seconds, especially when you are firing not to kill, not to assault, but ward off an attacker, which is exactly how the police behaved in the cases that I cited, where they were just firing to stop the person shooting at them from continuing to shoot. That is as reasonable, if not more so, an inference to be taken from this evidence. And again, I'll rely heavily on the fact that the Tahoe kept firing past the position.
Do we have ballistics testimony in the record that sheds light on how quickly you could fire this number of shots?
No. But we just have the description of the multiple witnesses who described it as happening in 5 seconds. Like
all
the neighbors.
Of the witnesses described it as a
nope.
course of seconds?
There were 2 by the state that said they thought it lasted a minute or more, which, as I pointed out, the simple math there is that all of the shots would have
to
happen.
We have to assume the facts in the light most favorable to the jury. So if you have some witnesses saying this was just a matter of seconds, other witnesses saying it was a minute or more, aren't we required under our standard of review to view the facts in the light most favorable to the verdict?
That standard is what's at play here, but the review and the evidence still has to be reasonable. And based on all the other evidence the state put in, the Tahoe had already left the neighborhood a minute or two after this incident started because they were flying over 60 miles an hour down the street and then back. The review of the evidence must reflect all of the evidence. And the sequence of the timing simply is not what was pivotal to the state's case and what the jury could have based their decision on. The state's emphasis was that the number of shots was excessive and unnecessary. The state did not emphasize this witness testimony that it lasted a minute or two because it's patently absurd. There are too many other witnesses who said it lasted mere seconds. And with that, I guess I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments today and your briefs. The case is submitted, and we will get an opinion out in the statutory time frame. And with that, we are recessed.
All rise.